I'd like to welcome everyone on behalf of the organizing committee to our workshop on inverse problems in medical imaging. And I'm John Shotland, I'm from the University of Pennsylvania. And I'll try to help anyone I can if you have any questions or concerns during the week. Before I get started and introduce Tom, I just wanted to say that we're very grateful to PIMS itself and also to the National Science Foundation for support and sponsorship of the workshop, and of course to the PIMS staff for all they've done to get us to this point. Our first speaker is Tom Budinger from Berkeley, and he will speak to us about how medical science will benefit from the mathematics of inverse problems. Tom?
Thank you, John.
Well, it's really a pleasure to be here with you all. I know about half of you, and that is, I know a quarter of you personally and the other quarter through publications. But I think I'll have something to say that will address aspects of the work of a little bit over half of you, even though it might be nothing other than a small cartoon. And Frank Netter, the cartoon I'll give for you will be just to picture your book. Let me tell you how I organized this presentation in anticipation of learning more aspects of all of these topics. This is not a time reversal ultrasound. This is a standard 3D ultrasound, but it was an appropriate thing to present to you at the beginning. I'll make some comments about ultrasound later on. This is nothing other than a child in utero, and it is mostly hardware, firmware, very little software, very little mathematics involved in this particular presentation. But there can be significant improvements, and the improvements will come from mostly signal processing types of mathematics related, of course, to the inverse problem. So here's an outline of the presentation. The a few historical milestones in terms of the kind of text and information that has been evolving in the recent past. I'm not going to go back to the 1929s in Ruga, but to the more recent past of computer tomography. And I'm going to show you, for the most part, ideas about new gantries, new configurations in the medical sciences, each one of which requires some improvements, and these improvements, I claim, will basically come from mathematicians, both applied mathematicians and pure mathematicians. So I will go through systematically some new ideas in X-ray CT geometries, PET geometries, SPECT geometries, and then some comments about ultrasound, and of course, Yoram Rudy will be happy to know that we are going to have something involving electrical source imaging, electric potential imaging, and many at this conference are experts in optical tomography, and I have little to say to add to that because I cannot bring coals to Vancouver, so to speak. So here's an unboring history. Recent history, and you might say, well, you could go back to something even earlier, but starting with of the early applications of computers to reconstruction tomography in the 70s, and of course we could go back to some texts, but these are all texts or available documents, some of which are available on the web, for example this one, and CAC's book. These are teaching texts for the most part. Now, I've tried to teach from Natter's texts without a great deal of success, even at Berkeley, because this is has some elements that are too advanced, but there are some fantastic parts of this that I bring to your attention. And I bring this all the way to a recent text. I'm not sure this is 2001 or 2. It's a Mathematics of Medical Imaging by Epstein. And there might be something more recent yet. But many of you are aware that there are 3D imaging meetings that encompass aspects of CT, PET, and SPECT, and a great deal of applied mathematics are in these 3D meetings, mostly focused today on the use of cone beam, and I will show you some reasons why that is so important and will be the segue into some future medical applications, many of which will affect all of your lives. And I make a comment about that with respect to X-ray CT. Now recall in the old days we had a source, that is an X-ray gun, and we had a detector and we moved them back and forth and around. I made slides over the last actually 20 years of the same old gantries and how they've evolved to the circular CT and how that's now evolved into the multi-detector helical CT system. What's important to the mathematician here is that there is a spatially variant spread function for the fan beam, and now one could envision, instead of multiple rings, a plate or a circular system, contiguous detectors, and even more than one X-ray gun in order to achieve imaging of a large section of the body. By large, I mean the whole head or the whole heart in half a second. The downside of that is that the detector system has not yet been developed, but there's nothing technically that would prevent that. But the second downside that has to do with the mathematicians here is that the doses, the X-ray doses, will be large. Why is this so important? Well, in a moment, we'll see what fantastic things one can do with a volumetric, three-dimensional X-ray CT done over the heart. The fantastic thing is that for the last 20 years, a little bit less, 18 years, we have struggled, I mean, myself, others have struggled, with use of MRI for imaging the heart, imaging the coronaries, imaging the function of the heart, etc. Now, that, I thought that was John's phone or something. I'll turn that off. It's a good cue to all of us to turn our phones off, I guess. Sorry, this doesn't turn off that fast, okay? So what are we seeing here? We are seeing the main coronary artery, and I would like you to focus on this area. And let me finish my sentence then about MRI. We have struggled for 18 years to perfect the MRI imaging protocol so that the patient could go into this dark tunnel and have an image of the functioning of their heart as well as the anatomy. We have not been successful in doing that. Never say never, but while X-ray CT was thought to be the old method and MRI was going to replace it, the fast scanning, and what is clever about fast, it stops motion. Therefore, it removes blur. Therefore, you have higher resolution. And in addition, if you do sequential images, you can get the function of the motion. So the fast CT then evolved in the last 5 years such that one could see the atheromata in the wall. Now, something I think it would be a delight to hear a mathematician say to a radiologist one day, well, is the disease of coronary arteries a disease of the lumen or disease of the wall? Because much of the activity has been to perfect methods of seeing the lumen in three dimensions, to see the tree. That's true for the brain as well. But for most situations, other than arterial venous malformations, aneurysm, the disease is in the wall. And if we have a method of seeing the disease in the wall, which could be X-ray CT as shown here. This is the atheromata. This is contrast injected CT done in about 6 seconds. Now the problem with this technique is the dose. The doses that are advertised by the companies are doses that are advertised for a very high contrast situation of seeing calcium in coronaries. Now, I haven't done calcium in my coronaries because I don't think it's important, but some of you might have looked at calcium in your coronaries as advertised by someone that Gunther, I think, is volunteering that maybe that's the case. It's a frightening thing that all of you here will probably have calcium in their coronaries. John, do you have any calcium in your coronary, whether you do or not? But calcium is a very high contrast signal. So you can have less photons in to get information about the distribution of calcium in your coronaries. And the doses for that are low, half a rad. Siemens advertises that they're as low as a background radiation in Berlin. Well, it might not be that low, but you can see a high contrast object with far less statistics. And what was clever about seeing calcium in the coronaries, because calcium didn't show up in the coronaries 10 years ago. Calcium was seen, though, 10 years ago because you could do a fast enough scan to stop action. And this was done first by Doug Boy, who used a sweeping photon or electron beam to get a fan and cone beam of photons fast enough over the heart that you could do images, in fact, in one slice images in about 0.4 seconds. Well, this is a fantastic find, and most of the radiologists of the world have referred patients for calcium, coronary calcium screening. I think most cardiologists would say this is not important. We all will have this, and Shinar will say to you, yes, well, MR could characterize the lesion, the coronary lesion. And this will not characterize the lesion. That is, you can have a big fat atheromata, which is not likely to cause trouble unless you see that it has a fibrin capsule or fibrin forming on this atheromata. And later, I will show you how some now what you might call nonlinear approaches to CT would allow you to see the fibrin on coronary plaques. And this is more to make a point to Shinar about what MRI can and cannot do. So what is the challenge here? It's to go from 5 rads to 2 rads. 5 rads is okay if you're sick and need that study. But it's not okay if you're going to screen individuals. And the idea here is to be able to see the coronary arteries, see the atheromata in the wall, and then, John, when you see your atheromata, you can make a decision of whether to have a prophylactic stent. And one would say, well, I don't want to have somebody stick a stent in my coronary arteries because, I mean, that might even cause clots. But now material science would let us make a stent, in principle, with carbon fiber or some other material that's transparent to X-ray CT. So you can actually, with these devices, see inside the current metal stents. You can see the thrombus forming inside the stent. So here's a way of fixing John, or prophylactically, and then every 6 months have him come back. You can see after 10 years, that's 20 times 5 rads. We would have done you a favor by giving you early aging, right? 200 rads.
Oh, so my coronaries are like that. They're open.
How do you know?
I just...
He feels good. So that's the challenge. So you'd say, well, what does that have to do with this conference? Later we're going to see the configuration of cone beam. Just think, if you had a cone beam and a detector array around the body for either doing dynamic studies of blood flow in the brain, this is with X-ray now, not with PET, not with MR, or the heart, and had a cone beam configuration where you use all the photons. All the photons going through the body are used. How much could you reduce the dose? Well, in general estimate, it's a factor of 2. A factor of 2 is a big factor in this kind of range of 2 rads or so. There's other reasons to think that mathematics would reduce the dose, and that's because we're dealing with basically a Poisson statistic probability density function for which one can do some things, particularly if you realize that you have the ugly problem of the spatially variant spread function. So there's work that can be done with the cone beam, and there are some recent literature. I'll refer to that, give you a reference after a few slides on the cone beam configuration and how that mathematics applies not only to X-ray CT but also to other developments, principally PET and SPECT. So now I'd like to move on to the configurations of PET and then configurations of SPECT. Notice a theme underlying this is the spatially variant spread function. So here in the PET developments in 1954, Hal Enger had a camera, even though we know that the first real PET studies were done in 1953. Hal Enger took his two gamma cameras and put them back to back. And so we had these annihilation photon detection systems, and this could be called, it was called then, longitudinal tomography. One could rotate this whole system, but then more efficiently, the detectors were put in a circle around the object, and you'll see in a moment the spatially variant yet symmetric spread function for this configuration. And by 1984, we were having multiple rings of detectors, and now even more multiple rings. Then someone decided they would make a less expensive system and make two arcs and rotate that arc. This has gone the way it should have gone. Back in the 1995, they decided to make some money by having a SPECT and PET machine, a hybrid machine, and they're back to doing what we were doing in 1954 and gave up. This has also gone the way that it should have gone. That is, it's no longer currently being used very much. And now in the last few years, we've had some new configurations that are pushing 2 millimeters. Well, this is not 2004 yet. We hope to be at 2 millimeter resolution, once again, with this geometry of a series of small detectors circling the patient. And I'll show you what the sinogram, or the doylygram that leads to a sinogram, for this kind of circular configuration, which might be a surprise to some of the mathematicians here, that in fact we have not accommodated this spatially variant spread function that will plague PET at a resolution of 2 millimeters and less. And I'll show you why that is the case. And finally, we have a new configuration, which is a box. And this is a series of detectors, and when you see the distribution of chords, that is lines of position, you'll realize the spatially variant spread function problem. But there's an additional problem having to do with something known as depth of interaction. So accompanying these gantry design changes, there's been an improvement in resolution beyond what people thought was possible. And not to go into detail here, but to make a point that as you improve on the resolution, there's various, I don't think we can see that, but this is our little constellation phantom image, and this region here is 4 millimeters, and a point to point for 4 points, and you can see them here, okay? We don't have to turn down the lights, just believe me, we can see it. The problem as you go smaller and smaller is that the range of the positron itself, the RMS uncertainty in position, is about 0.5 millimeters. When there's annihilation in the laboratory frame, there is an angulation because the positron has some motion when it encounters an electron, and that angulation is about plus or minus a quarter of a degree. That turns out to be a really serious problem, because a quarter degree will be a few millimeters for the usual gantry. So you're stuck with this Gaussian density function that limits your resolution in the range of 2 millimeters, unless you get in close. So between those two, that problem, and the problem that you'll see next, that is, not only is there an angulation, but look at this astigmatism. So if I have a positron source here, and the annihilation photon is detected by this crystal, should have been detected by that crystal, and then goes all the way through these other crystals and is detected by this crystal, you would think that the line of position is between here and here. That is, you would think the line of position is between here and here. But in fact, it should be between here and here. That is, there is a spread, an astigmatism, that goes out in the radial direction because we do not know the depth in which the interaction occurred. Now, the pure mathematician would say, well, make the crystal thinner. So, John, what's the trouble with making the crystal thinner?
I'm not a pure mathematician.
It's a mathematical answer. The problem is that you need an efficiency of detection that requires a depth of crystal. So the probability of interaction has to do with the depth, the energy of the photon, the density of the material. So we use as dense a material as we can find for a scintillator, but the photon still has requires some depth of tissue. So we could get rid of this problem if we had a very thin crystal, but that would cost us an efficiency. So what does it cost? It'd say, well, let's make it half. We can improve this problem here. See, this could be 1.5 millimeters, but this will be 3 millimeters. And this particular measurement, I think this is 2, and this is 4, 4.5. At any rate, that's a full width half max. The problem is one that physicists usually err on. They say, well, we can make a plastic detector very fast. We can do time of flight even. So we know the difference in timing between the arrival here and the arrival here. That tells us where along the line the event has occurred, and we've done tomography in a very efficient way. Time of flight will help in the statistics, won't help in the resolution. Well, the problem with these fast detectors is that they're plastic usually, they're very light, very fast. But if your efficiency went down from 90% to 10% for detection in each crystal, then what does that do to the decrease in sensitivity, overall sensitivity? So let's just say it went down by a factor of 10. It's reasonable, close. The overall sensitivity of the system goes down by a factor of 100. So I would have to give a subject 100 times more dose. And that's because the detection is in quadrature, right? The probability of arriving here times the probability of arriving here. We're in trouble with less dense or thinner crystals. So for this reason, there's a lot of mathematics going on to understand the scintillation process and thereby create an efficient, high-speed, more dense crystal system. And this is a Schrodinger equation solving activities that Steve DiRenzo at Berkeley is working on. So I promised you to show you some very simple geometry and then some more complex geometry associated with improving resolution. This is what we called years ago, this is in the 1970s, the doily pattern of lines of response or chords. So this is for an evenly spaced detector ring that is evenly spaced, even number of crystals, the pattern one would get of all the lines of all the coincidence lines. So this looks like something I found in my grandmother's house, and that's why we call it the doily pattern. We discovered in plotting the resolution, this is 1979, I plotted the resolution at the center, a quarter of the crystal spacing apart from the center, half the crystal spacing, three quarters, etc. We found this very interesting resolution. This is resolution. We found the resolution went up, down, up, down, as you went out. And it occurred to me that we might be able to change his doily pattern if we took out one of the crystals. That is, change the spacing such that there was an odd number. So a mathematician would think of this, right? Or an engineer. Anyway, by just changing the arc, this is 90 centimeters up. So if we put this, engineered this ring, this disc, so it opened up, in this case, I'm trying to think of the number, 8 millimeters. So there's a 90 centimeter ring, we're opening it 8 millimeters, so it behaves as if it's an odd number. What happens then to the doily pattern? Well, this will be empty, not empty, but yeah, that'll be empty, and then the rings will be interspersed. So it's like taking this doily pattern and changing it such that the superposition would make more of a uniform distribution. And we did that. Tremendous amount of engineering to make this work right, and the thing is moving back and forth. But that fills in this sinogram and makes a more uniform distribution and allows you to have uniform resolution, except for the problem of this depth of penetration. There is a way of resolving that problem. But let me show you now the doily pattern for a rectangular system. And you'd say, well, now you really have a problem here in doing the reconstruction, because you can do quite a handsome job with iterative reconstruction in this region, but outside this region, you'll have some difficulties. This is the associated sinogram. We haven't done a lot of work on how we might change this type of configuration to give us a better distribution, a better sinogram, but we have done quite a lot of simulations of this particular pattern to show how well we could do with either an animal system or a system that allows you to look at axillary nodes in mammography. So why? What have we done? We have looked at what would happen if we knew the depth of penetration in each detector. That is to say, we take all the lines of position that we have as if the photons interacted at the surface of the detector, but then take the additional lines if we knew where the cords would be if we knew the depth of interaction. And this is a tremendous increase in data, a ninefold increase in data. We know generally where we are within the first third, the middle third, or the bottom third of the detectors. And the way we do that is by having a detector. On one end we have an array that tells us which crystal is hit, and on the other end we have the usual photo tube telling us the energy and timing resolution. So we actually take the ratio of the information from the two sides of the crystal and calculate the depth, and thereby enhances sinogram significantly. How do these strange configurations help everyone in this audience except a few? So I got the minority with the breast imaging, and the majority, at least in this group of participants, with this new prostate system. I thought it'd be worthwhile showing you an instrument that's just been completed. We don't have data from this instrument, and that is an arc of PET detectors built such that we can move them in and out, so imaging URM might be most efficient if we can get it as close as we can, but then we wouldn't want to compromise somewhat slighter frame person such as Isaacson across the hips by having that wider spread so we can squeeze it in. Because the closer you're in, the higher the sensitivity. So what are the lines, all the cords of positions here, and what would they be if you had this depth of interaction? And that's a simulation that we've just finished. We're confident that this will work. Why are we building this thing? Because it's one-third the cost of the usual system, PET system. And we know that if we can locate where the prostate is, and that's easy to do with ultrasound, very simple ultrasound, we can do one injection of carbon-11 and get quite a handsome image with either carbon-11 acetate or choline of cancerous tissue in the prostate. So this is the problem that affects 20 million people die a year, men, about the same as breast cancer. But there's in the range of 250 million people that are really concerned about their prostate. And those are people that have a rising indication, a biomarker of prostate cancer. Those people have had prostate cancer and have had a removal or some therapy and want to know, is there a recurrence? What do you do about that? So this is a tremendously important situation, and what's interesting about the mathematics is that this odd configuration of detectors relative to a source requires some attention. And the only attention that we've given this is to prove that we can see results in different quadrants for a typical scenario. And instead of reading through this, let me just say, using straightforward iterative reconstruction with some attention to scatter, we're able to see very well with a very this is very closely simulated to the actual situation that we expect to see in a human. That if there is a small activity in the prostate in one or the other part, that we'll see it. For a background source to background ratio of 2:1, which is reasonable for the choline and acetate that we know will localize in prostate cancer. So moving on to the second half of animal PET, what's going to pay the salaries of some mathematicians is dealing with animal imaging systems, PET or SPECT. And I wanted to show you some recent work with animal PET. Here's once again the evolution to micro PET, and then a more recent machine that you can see is similar to our breast machine, and that will give a increase in sensitivity of factor of 30 or more over the current micro PET systems. So these systems are able now to image at 1 millimeter resolution. Why? Because they get in close. How much dose do you have to give? 100 or more times the dose that you would be giving a human in order to get statistics. But that shouldn't put us off, because many things that you could see with PET and SPECT, you will see without worrying that you've given a physiologically inappropriate or pharmacological dose. And I want to show you a nice plot from Simon Cherry, who's now at Davis, of the improvement in systems, animal systems, and human whole body PET systems over the years. And this is going to bottom out in this range, and in fact it has to do better than 1 millimeter. It becomes begins to push on the physical impossibilities. Because a 1 millimeter system requires about 1 to 1.5 millimeter thick crystals. And you get to a point where it's difficult to say whether the event has occurred in that crystal or the adjacent crystal. And this is a montage of results from Simon Cherry. It's very, very handsome heart images, and we recently did some work with Simon on fluorodeoxyglucose in the heart beating. So one can actually see the beating heart at 300 per minute in a mouse model. And why is this important? Because people want to look at the phenotype for various transgenic animals. And where does the mathematics come in this problem? It's the depth of interaction and the symmetric but spatially variant spread function. So SPECT, as Frank and I and some others know, offer offers an interesting mathematical problem. And just to go back to a little history, of course the history of SPEC started in the 70s, of quantitative SPEC, but giving the 1980s gantries, commercial gantries, a 12 millimeter resolution, 90s 7 millimeters, and now 1 millimeter with SPECT in animal studies that are feasible and are being done currently. And that is to say that SPECT, I predict in the next, well, currently and in the next 5 years, will continue to be higher resolution than PET for doing animal studies. And that's because of pinhole imaging. So this is cone beam pinhole imaging, and I'll show you some configurations for that. So in the 1980s, though, we had to deal with attenuation compensation. And although a good part of that work had been already done in the mid-70s, it wasn't incorporated in commercial systems until the 1990s. This is a triangular system. That is, the more detectors you get around, the better sensitivity, not necessarily the better resolution. And then scatter correction. If you have a hole that's 2 centimeters, that is no activity in 2 centimeters, surrounded by activities, and for 2 centimeters with systems that have in the range of 6 millimeter resolution, you'll have 50% of that hole filled. So quantitation in SPECT or PET, this is true for PET as well, must take into account the scattered radiation. So these are rather simple, almost engineering kind of calculations to do, but they need to be recognized. Clever ways of dealing with scatter in the projection space have been approached. Bergman from Sweden did the first of these, and there's yet more to be done. So finally, I show you in the last few years a sensitivity of 8 counts per second per microcurie, but this is 4D millimeter distance. So these numbers to the nuclear medicine people, to the researchers, are extremely important. What is a revealing is that the regular gamma camera that you do patients with has only 2 counts per second per microcurie. You can get 4 times that with a 1 millimeter pinhole system, a very straightforward geometric calculation. And this has been realized. So this is a summary, but it gives you an idea of newer configurations, shown in D here, of multiple detectors, multiple systems that in fact move in and out and back and forth in order to give you a spatially invariant spread function of focused activity. And this has been poo-pooed for about 20 years. But I'll show you some results recently that make one take a second look at this kind of configuration. And I call all of these things, I'd like to call them, aspects of coded apertures. I mean, after all, a lens you could think is kind of a coded aperture. Multiple lenses, multiple detectors, and pinhole are like coded apertures. So here's the configuration of 4 pinholes. They don't have to. A pinhole doesn't have to be a cone, clearly, but if you want to get side scatter, etc., out, pinhole can just be a plate with a little hole through it, and that's how the first pinholes were built. These have a fantastic capability to get down to very high resolution if you use things like I-125 low energy isotopes. So here's the pinhole dimension. Not the pinhole, but the resolution dimension. And here's the events, and you can get an idea. As a pinhole gets larger, you get more sensitivity. But of course, as you get closer into the object, and you can get very close to a mouse, you can get high sensitivity. This is why pinhole imaging is currently so interesting. But the mathematics is interesting as well. So here's a configuration of a single plane with what you could call comb beam geometry, 2 pinholes, or 1 pinhole, rotating about. Or you could have a pinhole offset from this pinhole. And here is our cartoon of the helical pinhole array. And just imagine then doing the mathematics for these lines of position for a pinhole that's up here, another pinhole that's here, and this array of pinholes rotating around to do high sensitivity mouse high resolution studies. Here's a reference. This is in this is an international conference. It was the fourth one of these 3D meetings. I have the reference with me for those that are interested. And for an appropriate geometry that covers 3 pi, because you can see if I have a pinhole or a fan beam with X-ray CT or a pinhole, the same situation, and I'm taking data around the object, the focus will be different with different depths of the object. The number of lines through each voxel will be variable in a symmetric fashion. And if I'm clever enough, I might find a kernel that would allow me to do an improved reconstruction. Now I'll turn to a special kind of collimator, that is a focus collimator with one big detector behind this collimator, 5-inch sodium iodide crystal. It could be a camera. That hasn't been done yet. And I put little sticks in this collimator to show you it has a focal point. Now we take many of these, let's say just 12 of these kind of detectors, and move them in and out and back and forth such that each spot in the object, not each spot, but most spots in the object, are covered by a focus. So this is these detectors moving in and out and back and forth, focusing on different parts of the object. John's looking at his watch. Here's the result. This is one of the highest resolution images in an Alzheimer's brain. There's a decrease in activity in this region of the brain. These are cuts that go down through the brain from here down to here. And very attractive result. This result is from a fan beam calculation that Hugh Stoddard's son did. And it's iterative reconstruction. Not the filtered or back projection, the filtered projection. So let me turn on to now seeing probably the most important biological activity in the body for the majority of people that are on the planet, well, at least in this hemisphere. And that's vulnerable plaque, coronary artery disease, stroke. And I drug out some old work that I did some years ago with Burns McDonald on using a Fresnel zone plate, different kind of coated aperture. There's no phase here. This is a plate with lead circles, concentric circles, a negative plate and a positive plate, a gamma camera. If I know this distance, of course we know that, I guess at the distance between the plate and the lesion, my objective here is to do very high sensitivity imaging of activity that would exist principally on a plaque. Small, but not with high background. And by actually changing this parameter mathematically, I mean computationally, I change the phase that I add to the hologram, or we'd call it the camera hologram. No phase here. I put phase in. That phase is associated with what focus the object would have if the activity were here, and do a reconstruction of successive planes, and that is nothing other than limited angle tomography. So if I have 3 spots here, if I'm focused on this plane, I'll see this spot in focus, these out, and so forth. So I got to show you an experiment. So I did this with 3 sources, or 5 sources, located in this plane, and you can see the kind of discrimination one sees. Of course, there's some background subtracted, so I didn't cheat here in showing you the actual reconstruction of the hologram. And my proposal is that we redo this study looking at fibrin on top of plaques, because I think it has a great promise with nuclear techniques that have been frustrated by MRI, with which I believe one of Chenard's publications reflect, although we used his work mostly in stochastic NMR. Now I'm going to conclude with some comments so that those of you in ultrasound can be can correct me and become more enthusiastic. So the evolution of ultrasound from the B-mode scanner, which is still used very much, and in fact we use this for the 3D work. Linear arrays, phased arrays, 2D phased arrays, there's still something to be done. And then we do have our French creator here. Is he here? Mr. Yes, okay. You were not left out. You thought you might be left out. This is your picture, okay, of time reversal or mirror. And I don't have more to say, because you're going to tell us about this. And it is a fascinating aspect of data manipulation. I wouldn't call this particularly a coded aperture approach, but to some extent it really is coded aperture thinking. Okay, quickly, John, I'm going to finish by making some comments about other modes of photon imaging. Microwave confocal imaging, this was being advertised over the last 20 years, and more recently in the last 2 years, some interest in building an array of antenna and to be able to look at things such as tumors in the breast. Why? Because the electrical parameters are so much different. The contrast mechanism is so much greater in principle than almost any other technique, because the electrical parameters are different. But the physics of this problem are very, very difficult. And I hope that through this conference we might hear more about how people are approaching that. Impedance tomography. Who's talking about impedance tomography here? Yes, sir. Dr. Isaacson. So John Webster gave me the second to last book on his shelf a few years ago, and made some comments that this was very frustrating for him. But I did teach a few classes, and out of those classes I realized that maybe John, as good as he is, should have pursued this a little bit further, and that's how I found out about your work. And so I thought I'd add some comments about never say no. And finally, Yoram, you might recognize this. I made this drawing from some of Yoram's work to just advertise here the problem of multipath imaging. This is the best I can do for you, John. Multipath problems. And they have different physical backgrounds and mathematical approaches. Then Miller, I can't leave out the fact that fusion is confusion, but I think that Dr. Miller will probably help us realize that you don't have to be confused in the area of processing objects and segmentation, etc. And this is one idea of not fusing but not confusing, by showing what the bone blood flow here is in L1, L2, and how that's related to both the MRI and CT. And why is this important to do? Because it is very clear that almost everyone in this room will have spots through their bony structure if I injected them with fluorine 18. And you won't know whether this is metastasis, a bone tumor, or just a structural defect. In order to find that out, we do have to do some mathematics. And what this is a simple mathematics of registration. So here's people who have helped me with various parts of this, whom I hereby acknowledge. And that's my presentation, John.
We have time for maybe two questions. Scott?
Just something that's like a silly question, but you have this, the pinhole filtered specs pictures up there, and you just gotten done talking to us about signal problems and efficiencies. And I'm just wondering, you know, how do you balance the price you're going to pay losing photons through that pinhole against, you know, the gains in the localization?
I want to start with saying something about the contrast mechanism that that you inherently have. So if you know, or if an object has a contrast of 2:1 instead of the usual contrast of anything from 1.05 to 1, which is true for X-ray CT, say a gray and white matter, to the usual in MR of 1.3:1. If you have 2:1, then, and you have an object that is this size, 2:1, with a resolution of an instrument that's 3 times worse than the object, you'll nevertheless be able to pick up that object. And you would like a lot of statistics. Now suppose, which I think gets at the heart of your subject, suppose we have an object with less signal to noise, 2:1, let's say 1.2:1, and we want to pick up that object with a system that has a resolution of, that's 3 times worse than the resolution of an object. So here's the resolution of the system, this is the object. You won't see that object because it'll be lost in the noise. So I've done those simulations. I mean, I take a Poisson distribution and just run this, kind of roll this across. It'll disappear in the noise. So what you need to do then is say, at what point at what resolution will I have to have in order to pick up this object with that signal to noise? And the noise will be pretty much the same in both systems. I mean, the you'd say, well, the statistics are different. So so maybe this is a kind of an engineer's answer. I do a simulation, just like I did, and I would find at what point I'll be able to detect with certainty this object. Now, I did something similar that I think Frank remembers. I looked at the propagation errors in reconstruction tomography. And I asked, for a given number of resolution elements, not pixels, but resolution elements in a field, how much data do I have to detect this object? And it goes back to Rose. You know Albert Rose? Some of you might have dealt with this. This is a Zenith engineer that wrote the original equations for how well can you detect something in a Poisson field given a certain signal to noise for a particular resolution. How much data do you have to have? So this is a similar problem for reconstruction tomography, except you need a lot more data. So how much is that? What are the equations? So I have to say that I haven't done the same for pinhole imaging of a flat object, which, you know, once you've done that, I think the rest would follow from my blabbing about the more, what I think is more elegant signal-to-noise equation that was done some time ago.
I have a short question. In this microwave imaging, that you showed one slide about, you said your comment was that it's very complicated. Could you make a couple of comments about what the issues are?
Well, it's a wavelength. The complication is diffraction. And it's a very similar problem to that encountered by light, except the wavelengths are very much longer. The sensitivity...
What centimeter wavelength?
3 centimeter.
3 centimeter wavelength.
Right. So 3 centimeter, even 10 centimeters, but a good part of the work has been done in the 3 centimeter wavelength region. And so to me, it's a problem that is similar to doing light reflection mode imaging, that is confocal light, where the wavelength is much longer and the penetration is much better than with light. Does that make sense?
I think so, except in thick tissue, I think that the scattering issues are very different for microwaves than they are for light. But in thinner tissues, I think that's probably correct. Tissues which are of the order of a few wavelengths in size.
But the physics is the same. I think the physics is the same.
Depends on the scale.
Qualitatively, it's quantitatively, it's very much different in terms of how much scatter there is. And do you remember Britt Chance's meeting where I took a laser pointer, we turned off all the lights, we looked at the laser pointer on the ceiling, put it through my hand and glowed? I mean, this is a no-brainer in a sense. Well, microwaves will do quite a good job in seeing a projection of my finger. But they won't do a very good job in seeing a projection through the brain. So the best resolution I've seen is in the range of 3 centimeters.
I think another problem with this technique is that of multiple scattering. So the imaging transform here would be described by a linearized Helmholtz equation, so we can't use a simple linear version algorithm to do that.
Yeah, but
that's fine.
Yeah, but at the same time, the multiple scattering is not such high order that it's probably diffusive either. So it's a much more difficult problem in some respect. Okay, I think it's time to wrap it up. Thank you again, Tom.
Okay.